Thank you. Well, good morning, everyone. See if the technology is working. I was given this topic to talk about, and I'm going to try to cover that today. But, of course, the first thing that people want to talk about now is what the hell's going on in the markets and the stock market and so on. And I just thought it was appropriate they put us on the ground floor, so when you jump out the window, you really can't do that much damage. I'm also here to tell you I don't know what's going on either. We can talk a little bit about it. I had my annual physical the other day, and the doctor said, you know, you can work a long time yet. And I thought that was really great. If I could convince my daughter to postpone college another 20 years, we'll come through this thing okay. But I don't think she's going to want to do that. One of the things I do want to start off with is I think agriculture is in a very, very strong position. Now, I know the meat side of that has not come through as well as grain, but as you think about it, we've had near record high prices. We didn't quite take out 2003, but very strong prices the last few years. Our costs are up, no doubt about it. Your land values have increased. There's a lot of very positive things out there in agriculture. The credit markets in agriculture are quite strong, but they are not immune to what's happening in the rest of the economy. The tighter credit that we're seeing on Wall Street and, quite frankly, throughout the world is beginning to bleed over into our agricultural credit markets. We had a discussion with the people from CoBank, which is one of the largest lenders in agriculture, and they're talking about as they work with cooperatives and agribusinesses and branded processors and so on, that you're having as higher inventory you have to finance, whether that be grain or meat. You need more equity to be able to borrow more money. The way you get more equity in those systems is you expand your margins. So markups are going to be higher on your fertilizer and your seeds and so on as they try to build an equity base to borrow to finance their business. If you haven't already noticed, those of you in the grain business, they're not just saying, you know, book your fertilizer and come pick it up in 16 months and then write us a check, at least in Iowa. We had to buy fertilizer this March for next year and then put down anywhere from a fourth to all of it 16 months in advance. Okay, so they're not wanting to finance those inventories. Forward pricing of grain. It was not uncommon for us to be able to forward price grain 2 years, sometimes 3 years in advance. And this summer's margin calls, co-ops are financing it. Grain elevators. Now we're down to 90-day, maybe 180 days, the most we can forward price on some things. So agriculture is changing, and it's impacted by credit and all these other factors that are going on. But as I say, I think we're in a very strong position going into what could be a very rocky road here for a while. But now, with all of that as some background, let's talk about more specifically what's the challenges within the beef industry. I'm going to talk to you today a little bit about the product trends and the meat side of things, some cost factors, and then some external factors. And throughout all of this, I'm going to at least give you my perspective over the next decade. You know what, economists, they always say we're very good at predicting history. And so I'm going to predict some history for you to kind of get us to where we are today, and then at least my perspective going forward. Let's start off talking about demand. And I find it interesting that the cattle industry didn't want to talk about demand for a long time. And in fact, we didn't talk about it until we got clear to the bottom. Once we recognized we had a demand problem, we fixed it. And demand bottomed out in 98 and rallied up until about 2004, thanks in large part to the Atkins diet and other low-carb diets. All protein was good. But we've lost a little ground lately. And so hopefully we can pick some of that back up. The other side of the demand picture, of course, is exports. We saw the 2004 effect, or December 2003, bottomed out, but we've rallied back very strongly. And so I think that's a good sign. The 2008 is kind of in the purple there. We've got 7 months worth of data on 2008. We're up about 37% on exports over a year ago. The red bars are forecast for 09 and 10. So we're not expected to get back to pre-BSE levels by 2010, but we're headed in the right direction, and it's coming back very quickly. One of the other things that's affecting that is price. This is the Choice Select spread on an annual basis. You go back in the early 90s, annual average Choice Select spread was around $4. It'd be on par in February, and it might be $5 or $6, $7 at its peak sometime during the year. And then you look at years like 2006 in there, where we average for the year over $14. We have been trending up. The other thing to note, of course, is after we have a good year, we have about two or three where it kind of backs off from that. And I think that's the boat we're in now. That last bar there, the 2008 number, is actually only through about the middle of September. Our spread will widen in the fall, as it typically does. And so that number will be a little taller before we're all done. But the point is, consumers are differentiating the product more than they were in the past. They're paying a higher price on the Choice and upper Choice prime cuts, and I'll show you that in a moment, than they are over Select. So the decade ahead, I think we're going to have some near term, and I don't know if that is 2 quarters or 2 years, but I think that we're going to have some pressure because of the economy, because of pocketbooks, due to the general economy, and beef gets impacted more than the other cuts because beef is more expensive than the other cuts. And I think we should be proud of that, but it comes with a risk. Aging baby boomers eat less beef. And judging from the hair color or lack of hair in this room, there's a few of us in here. We have impacted, as baby boomers, every segment of the economy we move through, from toys to cars to entertainment, all the way through. Why should it be any different as we move into retirement? But as we age, we generally eat less beef. Women live longer than men. Women eat less meat than do men. And so I think as we look ahead, that's going to be one of our challenges, is that we may not have that per capita consumption quite as strong as it was in the past. The other thing tied to baby boomers back to the economy, there's a lot of those people starting to come out of retirement that may not have as much disposable income as they thought they would a year ago. How does that impact their spending? I think we're going to see exports continue to grow in Asia, and I think we will see them grow in Europe. We've had this long-running battle about the use of growth promotants in the U.S. versus Europe, but we've been exporting beef to Europe since 1989 under the non-hormone treated rules. One of the reasons Europe pushed back so hard about the product, and their consumers are genuinely concerned, maybe ill-informed, but genuinely concerned about those products, is that Europe had always had a surplus of beef. That's changed. Their beef numbers are down. There is more opportunity there than in the past, and I think we'll see that market open up. Longer term, and we'll talk more about this, I think we'll see that Choice Select spread continue to widen, in part because I think the higher feed costs we're going to be dealing with in the future, we're going to see less of the choice beef on the market. I think that spread will widen out. So let's talk about Choice and Select. This is pounds per month, and these are a 12-month moving average. As you just measure 1 month at a time, you get a lot of noise in there. So I took a 12-month average over the past decade. The bottom line down there in the blue is prime. That's been relatively stable in a small part. The green is Select, pounds of Select per month. That's been relatively stable. And Choice has actually increased a little bit over time, and particularly if you start in about 2004 to current, the pounds of Choice beef on the market has actually increased. Now, typically, when we see that graph, we put it on percentage of cattle grading one way or the other, and the grades have slipped on a percentage basis. But because carcass weights are up, the supply of Choice on the market has actually increased. This is yield grades. And this is one of the challenges I think we have, yield grades on a pound per month basis. Let's start with the blue line there, is yield grade 1, and it started at about 200 million pounds a month, and it's declined slightly over time on yield grade 1s. Yield grade 2s are in the red, and it started at about 700 million pounds and went up to about 2000, or near 2000, and it's declined. Yield grade 3s have crept up in the green. And then the two at the bottom down there, the orange one, is yield grade 4s, is where we've seen the real increase. Up until early 2007. And then we've seen that level off. Now, what I don't know is why. All right? I'm not sure why it grew like it did, other than corn was fairly cheap. We put those extra pounds on there. We were starting to experiment with instrument grading, and I think we were beginning, one, the graders were being knew they were being watched, and I'll show you in a minute, I think we called a few more fours. And I think that contributed to that. Now, why did it change all of a sudden in a matter of about 3 months? Well, a lot of things playing in there. One, maybe the instrument grading, and there's been some issues of recalibration, have come into play. Perhaps the use of beta agonist, and more widespread use of beta agonist that puts on more pounds right at the end, makes those ribeyes a little bigger, carcass a little bigger, and changes the yield grade. There's a variety of things that come into play. The key thing is, and particularly as you think cost of grain, which is the other factor that hit about that time period, is we don't need more fours on the market. Okay. Let's talk about instrument grading. They've been working. In fact, yield grade using instruments have been around for a while, and the graders could always, over the last 3 or 4 years, could make the call. A human stamps it. A human makes the call, but they had the right to look down here at the monitor if one was right on the borderline and see what the computer said. And then they could make their call. We're getting there on the quality grades as well. So what does that imply if we do have instrument grading? This is some research we did in Iowa, and we had a plant in Iowa where we collect a lot of carcass data. We've got a team of people, the Tri-County Steer Carcass Futurity, that go in and measure carcasses on the cattle they feed every day. And they measure thousands of carcasses a year. They take the little plastic grid and count the dots to measure the ribeye, measure the back fat. And I feel, at least, that's a very accurate measurement. And we compared that to what the grader called on the same carcass. And notice that prior to June 30th of 2003, if you look at the yellow on the diagonal, that is the percent that measured yield grade 1, let's say, that were called yield grade 1. Or measured yield grade 2 that were called yield grade 2. And notice we were about 58% on 1s, 77% on 2s and 3s. 46% of those that measured yield grade 4 were actually called a 4. Actually, there were more of the 4s that were called 3s. So in spite of what you think about graders, they were doing you a favor. Because if it was right on the border, they would move air to the average. Instead of a $20 hickey, because it was a 4, you got a pass when they called it a 3. Similarly, on the 5s, it might be, doesn't change the price much, but downgraded to a 4. This plant put in 2 graders starting about the 1st of July in 2003, so that each grader had essentially twice the time to make a call of quality grade and yield grade. Okay, because there's 2 of them looking at a carcass. They had more time. Look what happened to the accuracy. Now, instead of 60%, they're at 87%. Instead of 76, they're in about 87, 90. You get up to the 4s, instead of 46%, they're 87% accurate. And I think that's what the machines will do for us. I think we will get a more accurate reading than what we had on the humans. They may find more 4s, they may find more 1s and 2s. Okay. And then when we move that to quality grades, I think we'll get the same effect. I think we'll get a more accurate reading. Okay, moving on. What's happened to the value of these cutouts? This is based on mandatory price reporting data starting in 2003. The green line across the bottom there is the spread between... Well, let's start with the kind of brown-colored line. That's the spread between choice and select. So it was as high as about $25 in 2003, more recently as low as about $2 this spring. In general, if you take that whole line, that spread's been trending down. I showed you that other one. You go back to the night, 1989, it's been trending up. The key thing is it's fairly variable. Some months it's good, some it isn't. If you look at the green line, that is the branded product, the upper two-thirds choice, whether that be CAB or something else, but upper two-thirds choice versus choice. That spread was around $5 to $10 earlier. It's narrowed a little bit as well as more of that product has come on the market. The prime in the blue dashed lines up there has been fairly steady. Prime over the choice price has been running $25, as high as $40 at times. So there is value in quality, in the quality grades. So the decade ahead, I think instrument grading will be fully implemented. I think we'll see that widely used in the industry. We'll get a more accurate measure. It is one more step for greater potential for data retrieval. And we've been saying you'll get data back for over a decade, and it hadn't happened very well. This is one more of those steps, whereas we go to more automation in the plant, the machine making that call, and not only be able to get a grader's call, but maybe get marbling score and very detailed information coming back from the machine. Now, we still have to link up that carcass to the live animal somewhere, and that means somebody in the blood pit there swapping tags or making sure our trolley tags match up, and we haven't got that perfected yet. But we're one step closer. I think I said greater emphasis on lean meat yield. I think that's going to be from the production side. That fat is expensive to put on, particularly with higher priced grain. But at the same time, with biodiesels, we'll talk about in a minute, tallow is worth more than ever before. So we're going to have this spread out there where maybe they don't discount fours quite so much because the fat has more value, but it's still costly to put on. And I think we're going to see that spread on the premium choice and the prime continue to grow over time. I think we'll see some growth in that, largely because I think we're going to cut the supply of those because of the higher priced grain. Let's talk about carcass weights. Again, looking back over the last decade, or 1998 through about end of August 2008, top two lines are steers and heifers. We've seen those trend upward. If you look at the numbers at the bottom, if you take the first 8 months of 98 compared to the first 8 months of 2008, steer and heifer weights have increased 6% over that time. If you think about what goes into carcass weights, there's genetics in there. There's the way we feed them. Are they calves or yearlings that may have changed over that? There's the pharmaceutical technologies, beta agonists, implants, and so on, that we've increased the use of those. All of those things add to carcass weight. We had cheap grain during a lot of that period, and we've seen that add to weights. Okay. Now, the green line there are cows. Our cow size has increased as well. And standing in a room of Angus breeders, it's interesting, I think, that you now dominate the industry in the color of cow out there, and they've still gotten big. We've got a lot of big Angus cows out there. Now, it appears that maybe about 2006, we might have peaked and begun to level off. But as we go forward and talk about efficiency in this industry, feeding that cow is going to be a pretty important part. It always has been a high-cost issue. It's getting higher. So what do we do about carcass size? Okay. The cow carcasses have increased 11% over that time period. Let's talk about efficiency for a minute, and bear with me. This is if you take the pounds of, let's say, beef produced, carcass weight beef produced per year, and divide it by the number of beef cows at the beginning of the year, you get a crude measure of beef per cow. Now, in all of these numbers, I've subtracted out imported cattle, so this would be U.S. produced beef from U.S. cows. Same way with U.S. produced chicken from U.S. hens, just the broiler side, and U.S. pork from U.S. sows. And this is the percentage change over that 10-year period. If 1998 was 100, that blue line there has increased about 6 or 7%. The red line and green lines have increased about 25% over 10 years. Okay, everybody place their bets. Which one is which? Beef production has increased about 6% per cow. About what carcass weights have increased over that time period. Pork is up about 25%. chicken per hen is up 25% as well. Okay? Now, let's just take a snapshot. This is 2007 carcass weight per female, same measure. One of them, actually two of them, are about 550, 600 pounds. One of them is at about 3,300 pounds. Place your bets. Beef per cow, about 550. Chicken per hen, about 550. Pork, about 3,300. Now, as you think about that, which of those would you want to carry feed to all year long? The hen or the cow? I didn't say which of those you'd rather eat. Thankfully, that's on our side. And we will never be more efficient than a chicken. Beef will probably never be more efficient than pork. So that means if we can't win that race, we've got to pick a race we can win. And that's where taste, eating pleasure, those types of things become that much more important. We can't ignore cost, because while consumers may pay twice as much for beef as they would chicken, or three times, there is some number where they would say, no, you know, I would just as soon have the chicken. So we've got to be aware of this. So the decade ahead, I think carcass weights are going to continue upward trend, particularly on the steers and heifers. I think part of it is we're going to have heavier weights going into the feedlot as we try to avoid as much corn feeding as possible. So heavier yearlings going in, we're going to have heavier carcasses coming out. The technologies that improve efficiencies, whether it be ionophores or implants or beta agonists, are that much more important at high-priced feed. I think we will use those, and those tend to result in heavier carcasses. Beef continues as a higher cost, higher priced relative to pork and poultry. That pressure accelerates at high feed cost. So that spread, particularly on the price side, is going to widen as we move to higher cost feed. I think our cow size, we're probably going to be this renewed emphasis on efficiency. I think we'll see the cow size steady to lower. That's your decision. But I think we have a new emphasis on how do we be as efficient as possible in our production systems. Let's talk for a minute about information and the trends that are out there. We're moving away from products or commodities to products. You guys led the way. You got the oldest, most successful brand in the meat business. You've been leaders in that. I think that will continue. But we're also seeing a multitude of different label claims. It's not just product claim anymore. There's other claims going on. Our consumers are increasing their expectations on the product, but it's still a show-me-the-money world. Right? There has to be an economic reason to make those changes, either through the price or through cost savings in some way. So let's talk about this. And the culture within agriculture has always been a high level of trust. You think about it. The business you do, feedlots buying feeder cattle, whatever it is, most of that's done over the phone. You take somebody's word for it. So high level of trust within agriculture. My word is my bond, my handshake's as good as gold. You've all heard that, you've all used that. But in the business world, if you can't prove it, it didn't happen. And unfortunately, agriculture and business are coming closer together on that. So the question is, how do we prove these things? Let's talk about some of the claims that are out there. Natural beef, right? Organic, grass-fed, age-verified, source-verified, genetic-verified, those are all claims that are becoming more and more commonplace. And we've always had product claims out there, right? Guaranteed open, they've had all their shots, they were fine when they got on the truck, right? Those are all claims we have made about the product. It's just those at the bottom, we always had ways of dealing with it. Either you didn't do business with that person again, and you made sure none of your friends did, or they made it right. But on these others, where we're dealing with a broader consuming public, the rules are a little different. On the feeder cattle side, for example, and many of your customers selling feeder cattle, the expectations on those are changing. We'll talk about that in a minute. But one of the things is the impact of health on quality grade. This is some work actually that CAB funded. It was done with our group in southwest Iowa, the Tri-County Steer Carcass Futurity. This was a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago. But they looked at the impact on these characteristics, grade in particular, but also performance, of whether the animal was sick enough to treat. So the first column there, the zero, is how often they were treated. That's the ones that didn't get pulled for a treatment once they got to the feedlot. They were either pulled and treated once or pulled and treated twice. And if we look, this percent change compares the treated twice, the ones that were sick enough to be treated twice, versus those that didn't need treatment. The percent grading prime was cut by 50%. The upper two-thirds choice, the CABs, was down 29% if they got sick. Low choice, down 12%. Of course, those animals moved into the select category. That went up. Standards went up dramatically. There weren't a lot of standards, but it went from 2.6% to 10%. The graded standard. Yield grades, if you got a market that pays a yield grade on, you know, ones and twos, there's your chance, you know, your opportunity. Just get sick cattle, they grade yield grade one and two just about all the time. Yield grade, get down there, average daily gain, 5%. Decline in gain. My favorite one, mortality rate. Right? You treated them twice and they still died. Went from a tenth of a percent death loss on healthy cattle to 8.7% on those that you put some money into. Now, what? Speaking of money, if you put that through a typical feedlot economics and a grid that we would sell on in Iowa, those that were treated once, a single treatment, the ST, was about $85 a head cost on that animal. Those that had to be treated twice were about $200 a head kind of cost. Now, how can we impact cattle not getting sick? Well, there's probably a genetic connection, but certainly there's a management connection. Vaccination programs, preconditioning programs, healthy calf programs all impact that. And while back when it was that 5% change in average daily gain, I might take your word for it that they had all their shots. When I got $200 on the line, I want to know how these cattle are going to perform. The stakes are higher. The expectations of the customer, the buyer, is higher. We did a little experiment. We looked at 9 auction barns in Iowa, 105 different sales, over 20,000 lots of feeder cattle that went through the sale barn, and asked the basic question of, does the amount of information about vaccination and weaning impact price, and does the source of that claim impact price? So our base was the calves weren't vaccinated and they weren't weaned. That's our starting point. We adjusted for hide color and weight and dirt and mud and horns and nuts and everything else that impacts price. All of that was in there. And then this is what was left. Okay? If they were obviously weaned but not vaccinated, they got $1.70 a hundred over not weaned and vaccinated. If they were vaccinated, proof of vaccination like in Iowa, green tag in their ear, but they weren't weaned, they were balling calves, that was worth about $2.40 a hundredweight over no information. Those two were not different from one another statistically. Now, if they were vaccinated, again, proof of vaccination, but no proof of weaning, just the claim that, yeah, they've been weaned a long time, or the other one, they had all their shots, no proof of that, but other than the seller's claim, and they'd been obviously weaned 30 days, and that was worth about $3 to $3.40. Those two are not different from one another. They are different from the other. The final one is, in at least in Iowa, we have the green tag preconditioning program where a veterinarian vaccinates cattle and a veterinarian signs that they have in fact been weaned at least 30 days. So there is a third party signature that they have been vaccinated, they have been weaned. All else equal, those cattle got a $6.15 premium over no information and nearly a $3 premium over the claim made by the seller. So our conclusion is that proof does have value, at least in that particular market. Other market access programs that are growing, organic is a very small program. but it's out there. The non-hormone treated cattle to export to Europe has been around for a while. It is growing. And then various process verified or PVP programs. Age verification for Japan. There's a new grass-fed standard for what it means to be grass-fed that is a PVP program. And there is a proposed naturally raised standard out there that is a PVP. There's also the Never Ever 3. No antibiotics of any kind ever. No mammalian or animal proteins ever. And no growth-promoting implants ever. That's PVP. The USDA process-verified programs are audited programs. The Angus Source is a PVP program for age verification, as an example of that. So in the decade ahead, I think there's increasing consumer and customer demands. Not demand of our product per se, but demands on our product. These expectations will be higher. The USDA programs are out there to protect the consumers from fraud that says, yeah, they're natural, trust me, versus those of you who really do produce that product. So it protects both the markets, the seller and the consumer. The affidavit approach that we've seen in some natural programs, we see in country of origin labeling, I think will give way in some cases, particularly on product markets, to the more audited programs that are like PVP. Brands are the new regulations. CAB has rules and regulations about their brand. We see that in other programs. I think that that is going to be increasingly important. And at the end of the day, I think the minimum standards for all of us raise. Now, one of the things in all my current soapbox, one of my many, I want to talk to you about, this idea of brands as the new regulation, I think is an important one to watch. As you think about how regulations have been and currently are implemented, let's say it's an environmental regulation, it's a food safety regulation, it's a marketing regulation, there's typically some research goes on someplace. The industry will demand sound science. They will ask Congress to fund the research, maybe two or three research studies. That'll come forward. There'll be a public hearing. There'll be testimony before Congress. The bill will be written. Lobbyists will have inputs. Trade organizations will have input. You'll call your congressman and have input. And a bill and a rule will finally come out to develop a regulation. There's a lot of input. Agriculture has a place at the table. Brands, however, are different. Let me give you an example. Starbucks made the decision that they did not want to have milk from cows treated with RBST. They sat in a boardroom, made that decision, and boom, it no longer happened. Where was the science? Where was the input from agriculture? Where was the research, the lobbying, all the things that went into that? They just made a decision. What happens when, let's talk about animal care, animal well-being, you know, the rules, the things that McDonald's and others have come up with. I don't think many of us would argue with those, but at the same time, they didn't have a lot of input across the industry on it. I think we'll see more and more of that as we go forward, as companies try to differentiate their product and set it apart from someone else because of how it was produced. Now, you as producers, that directly impacts. So one of the things to watch for as this goes forward. All right, let's talk about some of the external factors that are going to drive cost. Higher energy, we'll talk about that, obviously. The bioeconomy expansion. And what's going on there, input cost, you folks well know, are rising, and competition and cost of land. All of those impact your cost. On this oil issue or energy issue, and this has been coming for a long time, we only need to go back to January of 2002. Oil was $20 a barrel. And it has increased pretty dramatically. It's backed off again back around 90. Now, the government forecast, and this is back in March, was for oil to average around $55 to $60 by 2016, but move back up beyond that. I think the message there is, as a forecaster, I don't bitch about their forecast when I have to make my own. But the point is, it wasn't going to stay at 140 forever, but it probably wasn't going to go back to 20. We're dealing with oil prices somewhere kind of from maybe 50 to 100 as we move forward on this. So what? Well, the so what is, it has implications on freight rates. Any of you that sold calves and happen to live outside of the cattle feeding area know about freight rates. Right? Well, that's happened to feeder cattle bases if you're in Florida trying to move cattle to Texas. Okay? But it's also had impacts on corn prices. This graph up at the top up there is the rail rate for moving corn from Omaha to Amarillo, for example. And the price of moving corn from Omaha to Amarillo has doubled in about 5 years. To move it to North Carolina, it's up about 80%, to California about 80%. So the price of moving that grain around has changed. The other thing that's happened is fertilizer prices have increased, tied back to the energy market. Well, as the price of fertilizer has increased, so has the value of manure. And in fact, the numbers you see on that chart is the value of the nutrients coming out the back end of a steer. And we went from about $10, well, $7.35 in 2002 to $33.20 per head in 2008. The long-run profit of feeding a steer is somewhere between $0 and $20 a head, and they're producing $30 worth of fertilizer. If you can use the nutrients. Now, if you were in a place that can't grow enough grain and have to truck it in, you don't have any use for the nutrients. Those are a cost. But if you're in a place that ships fertilizer in by the train load, manure has value. This is an example looking at the Midwestern situation. Just the change because of those two variables, cost of moving grain out of a corn surplus region like the Midwest to someplace else, and the value of the nutrients, not the total value, just how much they've changed in 5 years, it's over $45 a head on feeding cattle. So will we see a change in where cattle are fed? Perhaps. The economics push that towards corn-producing regions like Nebraska. Okay? And out of places that have to truck grain a long ways, and nutrients are a huge cost to them. Ethanol. Maybe you guys don't talk about ethanol in this part of the world, at least not in mixed company. In Iowa, we're pretty proud of ethanol. Iowa happens to be underneath that pile of dots up there, kind of in the center part of the country. Green dots up there are ethanol plants currently in production. These will all be corn-based. Yellow dots are those that are expanding or new. And some of these dots down in places like California, Arizona, Georgia, you ask them where they're going to get their corn, a lot of them say, well, we're going to get it in Iowa. Well, folks, there's not enough corn left in Iowa to go around. So it is growing rapidly. This is an estimate of where we're going with that. The red line there is millions of bushels, so we're at about a little over 4.5 million bushels now, expected to go up a little over 5 billion bushels of corn used for ethanol once we max out. That will be about 30 to 32% of our expected corn crop at that time. This is the renewable fuel standard. This was the energy bill that was signed December of 2007. That greenish yellow at the bottom is corn-based ethanol. We are targeted to be just over 10 billion gallons of corn-based ethanol in 2009, and we will meet that. It is expected, in fact, by law, will peak in 2015 at 15 billion gallons. We have enough plants where concrete is poured and they're coming online to be at about 14 billion gallons within about 2 years. So there is an end in sight on corn-based ethanol. It's at about 15 billion gallons about 6 or 7 years from now. The blue area that starts down there close to zero and goes to about 15 or 16 billion gallons is cellulosic ethanol. We can make it kind of a shot glass at a time today on the lab bench, but we're going to, by law, hopefully the scientists read the law, can get us producing at that level in the future. The yellow stripe that goes through there is biodiesel. That's got a mandate of 1 billion gallons of biodiesel a year. That's soybeans and animal tallow, reused cooking oil. And then the purple is other advanced biofuels. So that's where methane could fit, other forms of cellulosic ethanol, and other biological energy sources. Are ethanol plants making any money? Well, today they are. This was last Friday. You get about 2.8 gallons per bushel. Ethanol at the plant was selling for $2.08 a gallon. Distillers, dry distillers, $1.35 a ton. That gives you almost $7 worth of revenue per bushel. Corn, they were paying at the plant $4.24 on last Friday. So that left them $2.73 over the price of corn. We estimate the operating cost, the variable cost, of about $1.75. Fixed cost, depending on when they built the plant, between about 60 and 80 cents a gallon. So at least on Friday, those plants were certainly covering variable cost. Most of them are covering total cost. So I think they will continue to operate, continue to open. Here's just a little estimate of tying gas prices to corn prices. We got gas price across the bottom and corn price on the side. The lowest line there is if they had to pay total cost and you took away the blender's credit. So with $2 corn or gas, we'd have about $2 corn if they had to carry all the weight themselves. Okay? At $4 gas, you're up to about $7 corn. If you leave the credit in there, the other blue line, $2 corn, you got about $3.20. $2 gas, you got about $3.20 corn. The key message here is corn prices are now tied directly to oil prices. Okay? And oil prices have come down, corn prices have come down. What else is going on in alternative energy? Biofuel, we talked about, will drive soy prices. So the idea that we got plenty of land, we'll just quit planting soybeans and start planting more corn. We got to plant soybeans. So we're going to keep the demand for land high. Cellulosic ethanol is going to compete with cows for roughage, whether that's grass or store or corn stalks or straw or whatever. Cellulosic ethanol basically is a rumen. Okay. Animals is an energy source. Methane production, I think we're going to see increased emphasis on that. The tallow prices have increased dramatically because of the value for biodiesel. We're going to talk about and see more carbon credit trading as we capture more carbon. And green energy. We've got a feedlot in Iowa putting in a methane digester. It's going to sell electricity or methane, one of the two. It's going to sell carbon credits, and it's going to get paid by a private company, I think 3M, for the green energy credit. So it's going to collect two or three other streams, plus it's going to get paid by the city for taking its waste to digest with the manure. And so they're looking at how we use manure as a carrier to make money. So the decade ahead, corn linked to oil prices, the genie's out of the bottle. If all of the mandates and protections and so on went away tomorrow, we still got 10 billion gallons worth of capacity built. And while they might change hands and change names on the outside, as long as they can cover variable costs, they will operate. So that genie's out of the bottle. What could change? Oil could get cheaper. And it has, compared to last summer. The cheaper the oil, the more difficult it's going to be to operate those plants. More grain production around the world. We're seeing that already. Expansion of cellulosic. But I think it's also time to maybe rethink some of those business models that were built on cheap energy to move grain any place in the country. Cheap fertilizer, because we don't need manure. We can just buy nitrogen from the co-op. And cheap corn, so we don't care about feed efficiency. Why would a business model built around that be successful in the future when none of those things exist anymore? What about feeding this stuff? Very quickly, we looked at just feeding kind of the 5 years ending in 04, corn averaged $2. 2006, it averaged $3, so a 50% increase in corn prices. What about feeding the product, distillers' grains? We got feedlot, dairy, swine, and layers. Red is not feeding any of it, but facing higher prices. Blue is low levels in the diet, and yellow is high. And the message there is cattle can use this product quite well. Costs are still higher than they were before, but they come down dramatically as you use more of the wet product. The monogastrics, the swine and layers, Distillers Grains is not an advantage to them. Their cost did not decrease as we go forward. So it gives us an advantage on the feeding end. What about cost? This is a real simple exercise of how much can I, as a feedlot, afford to pay for a calf, 550 weight steer calf. If, let's say, if fed cattle are a buck and corn is $5, I can afford to pay $116 for that calf. The trouble of it is, cow herd's variable cost is probably $120. The feedlot can afford to pay you $116. Anybody see a problem there? Okay. This is some Kansas data out of K-State, their Farm Business Association. 2007 actually had cow herd cost at about $135 a pound on total cost of actual records. So cost of increase. Land's a big part of that. This is what's happened to pasture values, U.S. in total. We've gone from about $500 an acre on average across the U.S. to $12 and some change. If you look at pasture values in 2008 and the change from 2007, that Midwest and the Plains, some of those have gone up, you know, over 10% in 1 year. Two things are driving that. Competition from the corn planter and soybean planters driving up anything they can drive over. And the other part of that is yearlings. Cost of gain is so high in the feedlot feeding them corn, I'm willing to pay more to put the gain on grass. Either way, it's bid up grass land. This is the price of hay relative to the price of corn. Blue line is hay, and corn prices the last couple of years have outpaced it. And those are both on a per ton basis. The green line is the ratio. And this is the lowest ratio of hay to corn we've seen in over 10 years. And my argument is we're probably going to see hay prices increase further. So again, you're going to have cost pressure. Trouble of it is your customers and you are squeezed in the middle. Downward pressure on calf prices because of high cost of gain. Upward pressure on cost because of higher land and forage prices. We're going to downsize the cow herd. Competition for land, competition on hay, non-feed costs such as energy higher as well. It's time to rethink economic efficiency. What is the optimal, not the maximum production, but the optimal production from the resources you have? Cow herd, or number of cow herds in the U.S., we know those are declining, but if you dissect it, it's the under 50 cows, herds that have declined. Those 50 to 100 and larger, those numbers have been relatively stable. But as you look at that, that under 50 cows make up 28% of the calf crop. Probably 28% of the bulls purchased in the U.S., if not a higher percentage. Probably not the best ones, but certainly a large number of them. And those are the ones kind of continuing to slip away. So as you guys look forward, who is your customer base and what's happening with them? Cow numbers, as we said, have been declining. It used to be one of the most predictable things in agriculture was the cattle cycle. Right? Every 10 years it repeated itself. The only more predictable is how surprised everybody was when it happened again. Well, this last cattle cycle was 14 years long with a 9-year liquidation phase. We had an 18-month expansion phase, and we're back in a liquidation phase again. Higher land cost, higher cost in general is pressuring the cow numbers. So as we move ahead, I think we'll see this cow inventory decline probably till 2010, maybe 2011 before it bottoms out and begins to rebuild. We're going to lose pasture to crops. We're going to lose grazing to yearlings. But I think when it comes back, we're going to be at higher prices, obviously. We're already at higher prices than we ever dreamed about 10 years ago, and I think we'll see those move higher yet. Right there is your take-home message. The world in which we operate is fundamentally different. Higher energy costs, different energy policy. The fact that the U.S. has a renewable energy policy and focus is different. The rocky times we're in the economy right now are different. Corn prices are different. Consumers are different than they were. What are you doing differently on your farm? And why would a plan that maybe was very, very successful over the last 20 years be successful going forward when a lot of the foundation has changed? I think we have to at least stop and reevaluate those things as we look forward. So with that, I'm going to quit. I see I've used up all of my time and probably then some. We've got time for maybe one or two quick questions.
We have time for questions.
Got one here and then here.
Dr. Lawrence, you kind of touched on it, but for this group of people that have been very successful producing grain-fed beef, you know, how fundamentally and drastically has that changed? I mean, do we really need to be concerned about with grain prices and some of the things you said? You know, elaborate a little bit more on that.
Well, I think the U.S. niche is grain-fed, and I think that is strong. I think we will change how we do that. I think we'll see extended backgrounding programs. I think we'll find out what is the least amount of corn that we can put into an animal and still get a superior product that we're after. I think we'll probably see that market differentiate more where we will have a superior product, but we're still going to have a lot of commodity out there. A lot of people still drive kind of the Chevys and maybe even an old Chevys, and we still got to be able to produce that product and put it out there in a cost-effective fashion. We've been doing some research, and again, we have access to wet distillers' grains. We finished cattle completely without corn. Grading was off a little bit. We had maybe 30% choice. We have taken cattle up to about the last 60 days without corn, put 60 days in them, and they graded just like those that fed corn all their life. And so I think we're going to be finding different ways of doing some of these things. So one question here, and then I better shut up.
When you were talking about the graders looking at yield grades, I'm sure you looked at quality grades too. What did those numbers look like?
Well, and actually we didn't look at quality grade. And the reason we didn't is then it's just one man's opinion against another man's opinion or woman's opinion and so on. The yield grade we could objectively measure. We could put the little plastic grid on there, which they do, and they could count dots, and they could measure the thickness, and they could calculate that yield grade, whereas the grader's just glancing at it and doing the same thing. The marbling, we could not, because then it's, well, that looks like that's a, you know, slight 60 or whatever, and they might call it something different. They are doing that exercise with the instruments, the calibration process, and I've not been engaged in that, so I can't tell you for sure. So, okay, with that, I'll thank you very much.
Thank you.